This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents On the Shoulders of Titans, Book 2 of Arcane Ascension, written by Andrew Rowe, performed by Nick Podell. Recap. Attunements. From Kara Salirian's research notes, prior to sufficiently advanced magic. On this continent, no one is born with magical abilities. Instead, when humans reach a certain age, which varies from nation to nation, they're eligible to visit their local soaring spire for something called a judgment. The spires are huge towers filled with monsters and treasure. They're also basically giant death traps. Their goddess must have a sick sense of humor. That seems to be an unfortunate trend among the gods I've encountered in general. Yeah, so, survive a judgment and you get an attunement. Attunements are marks, seemingly similar to the Dominion marks from back home, more complex. I have some theories on how they work, but I'll get into that later. You don't get to pick which attunement you get after you finish your judgment, as far as I can tell. And the place the attunement shows up on your body impacts how your magic works. It seems like people can train to work around that, but the location of the mark determines what is easiest for you. These are the attunements for the Kingdom of Velia, where I'm visiting soon. Diviner. Standard information-gathering attunement. They can also make memory crystals and store memories inside. Mana types. Mental, primary. Enhancement, secondary. Guardian. Guardians are capable of focusing mana into specific parts of their bodies, imparting vastly enhanced physical combat capabilities. Also capable of discharging their mana through contact, enabling them to harass creatures impervious to conventional force. Mana types, enhancement, primary. Life, secondary. Elementalist. Ranged combat experts with fire, air, and lightning magic. Mana types, fire, primary. Air, secondary. Enchanter. Capable of imbuing items with permanent enchantments, similar to Dominion marks back at home. It's strange to see so many items with runes around here. Mana types, transference, primary, mental, secondary. Mender, healers, enough said. Mana types, life, primary, earth, secondary. Shadow, concealment specialists. They can also use shadow magic to suppress other forms of magic and have some physical enhancements. Mana types, umbral, primary, enhancement, secondary. Shaper, able to conjure and manipulate mana constructs, including simulacra. Extremely flexible. Reportedly excellent duelists. Mana types, earth, primary. Enhancement, secondary. Summoner. Form contracts with monsters to exchange their own mana for some of the monster's power, similar to soul blades up in Delanos. I'd love to learn more about how these work. Mana types, air, primary. Transference, secondary. Attunements get stronger as you use them. As your attunement gets stronger, the color of your aura changes. Locally, they refer to attunement levels by gemstone names. Some of the other nations use other styles. The colors of their auras follow the same color of the rainbow. They are as follows. Quartz, clear aura. This is the level where people start when they first get an attunement. Carnelian, red aura. At this point, people develop an aura that protects them from attacks called a shroud. Sounds useful. Wish I had one. Sunstone, orange aura. At this level, generally learn to manipulate their shroud, including suppressing their attunement abilities to avoid detection. Citrine, yellow aura. I always get this confused with carnelian. At this level, they gain access to another type of magic. Emerald, green aura. This level supposedly lets them manipulate ambient mana. Sapphire, blue aura. They claim these don't actually exist, but I'm pretty sure they do. Notably, some of the attunements don't give out abilities in exactly the same sequence. For example, guardians get their shroud immediately at quartz, and I've seen some attunements that can suppress their shrouds as soon as they get one. I'll write down more notes when I'm done with this visit. I have a feeling it's going to be a long one. Recap. Sufficiently advanced magic. Okay, Karis. In case you don't remember me, I'm Corn Cadence. We never really were properly introduced. I'm a student at Lorien Heights Academy right now, but we met a little before that. I suppose that's a good place to start. I'm sure you remember being in that weird crystal prison. Well, when I found you, I was supposed to be taking my judgment. That's a test that someone can take when they come of age in Velia, assuming they can afford the entrance fee. There were two main reasons I wanted to take a judgment. One, because surviving one means you get an attunement. Each attunement comes with magical powers, and everyone wants magical powers, right? Right. The other reason is a bit more personal. My brother Tristan disappeared when he took his judgment 5 years ago. Everyone told me that meant that Tristan was dead. I wasn't convinced that was the only possibility. But even if he was dead, I also knew that if I managed to get strong enough to climb all the way to the top of the spire, I could ask the goddess for a boon. Bringing my brother back to life seemed like a reasonable thing to ask for. Of course, climbing all the way to the top of the spire would be much harder than just finishing a judgment, but I needed to start somewhere. Our local judgments are held inside the Serpent Spire, one of the 6 soaring spires. I assume you went in through the Climber's Gate, which is a different entrance meant for groups of veterans who are trying to climb to the top of the spire. Yeah, thought so. Anyway, I found a book early on in the test, Trials of Judgment. When I opened said book, it started to give me advice. No, not verbally, that would have been even stranger, but possibly more hilarious. Text started to appear on the pages. It wrote me helpful comments about each of the rooms I was going through, like, this is the room of eternal death. It's like the room of normal death, but somewhat more repetitive. That sort of thing. For reasons beyond my recollection, I followed some of the book's advice, and I found a secret passage. That led me to your prison. You and 2 others, Ekion and Vera, were in different jail cells. At the time, I didn't know if that was a part of the test or if it was real. It did seem a little bit weird for me to find just enough keys on the way to open 2 cells, but not the 3rd. I opened the other 2 cells, and then you cut your way out with your ridiculous swordsmanship. Apparently you were waiting until the other 2 were free because cutting yourself out earlier would have triggered traps that would have incinerated the other 2. You started leading the way out. Unfortunately, we were interrupted by one of the visages of the goddess, Katashi, and he wasn't very happy to see us. It was strange to see Katashi in the Serpent Spire, since that's the territory of his brother, Tenjin, but we were a little too preoccupied to worry about that. The rest of us ran like cowards while you fought him. Good work on surviving that, by the way. Not sure how you managed that one, considering visages can wipe out cities with an angry glare. Maybe he thought you were cute? Okay, maybe that wasn't it. Right, anyway, Vera stabbed me in the back just a little and ran off with Ekion. As you might imagine, I was pretty disappointed by that. I managed to make my way out with some more advice from the book, and I even picked up a magic sword along the way. That was nice. I'm glad the goddess seems to like leaving one-of-a-kind legendary artifacts lying around in towers. Oh, and I even managed to get an attunement, like I'd entered the spire for in the first place. The problem? I got the Enchanter one. No one likes the Enchanter attunement. Least of all my father, Magnus Cadence. I got a mild case of verbal lacerations when I got home. Also, the girl who had been raised to be my retainer, Sarah, got promoted to family member, that is presumably your sister. This was probably because she got a much better attunement than I did, a summoner mark. It might have also been because of my father's general disappointment in me, though. Or maybe it was just some kind of contrived plan to get Sarah and me to compete with each other and excel. My father underestimated us. After all, competing would have required actually talking to each other about the situation. We were far too clever to talk out our differences and concerns ahead of time. Infinite social skills. That's me. Right, so after that, Sarah and I got sent off to Lorien Heights to spend 2 years training there before our years of military service. We were assigned to divisions, which weren't really important, except for the fact that we're eventually supposed to figure out who the members of Spider Division are. Spider Division has members infiltrating the other divisions and probably sabotaging them. I still haven't worked on that because I've had higher priorities, like not dying. I'll probably work on it eventually. At the academy, I learned all sorts of things about enchanting, like how to blow off my own hands by experimenting without asking the right questions first. No, I didn't literally blow off my own hands. After that, Professor Vellum, who didn't want to spend the money on buying me new hands, decided to teach me some things about enchanting in non-combustible ways. So, yeah, we took some tests, I learned magic, that sort of thing. Even made some friends, I guess. Or reconnected with an old friend, in Patrick's case. Aside from Patrick, there was Marissa, a guardian with impressive punching abilities. I suspect you'd like her. Oh, almost everyone calls Marissa Mara. I'm terrible with nicknames, though, so I forget sometimes. Aside from that, there was Jin. I made him a bunch of items. He helped me out with a few things, too. We got close. He asked me to the Winter Ball. It didn't work out for reasons that will be clear later. Anyway, during one of my tests, part of the school kind of exploded. Turns out that Mizuchi, one of the children of the God Serpent, was on a rampage. And that rampage was because Kitashi, the visage we'd run into earlier, was somewhat upset. Long story short, his brother, the visage Tenjin, was missing. Considering how much I wanted to get my own brother back, I could sympathize. I talked to Kitashi. Surprisingly, this sort of worked. Emphasis on the sort of. He put a weird brand on my hand that would supposedly explode if I didn't find the person he wanted. I don't know why I have a pattern of running into hand-destroying situations, but that seems to be my lot in life. Maybe I need to figure out how to make magical prosthetics. I should research that later. Do I have a list of things I need to get back to? Nah. Why'd I need that? I have a great memory. Anyway, where was I? Something about the spire, I think. Oh, Kitashi, thank you. Anyway, I needed to find Vera. I talked to Professor Orden and she instructed me to put together a team. She also explained that she was a Whisper, a member of a secret organization dedicated to one of the visages. I worked on putting together a team as she'd instructed. Sarah was an easy choice. I would have brought Marissa and Patrick, but Marissa was recovering from a gift of power given to her by Kitashi, and Patrick lost at a coin flip to Jin. In retrospect, I should never have allowed Patrick to flip a coin against someone with illusion magic. I was expecting to bring our dueling teacher, Lord Taft, but Orden overruled me and brought Derek Hardigan instead. Derek was one of the most powerful swordsmen on the continent, so the choice made sense, but I was suspicious of Derek because of his connections. Anyway, we went and found Vera. That wasn't the hard part. The hard part was that we had to go back into the spire, and for reasons that I will never understand, Kitashi didn't give us any sort of way to just tell him when we'd arrived, so we had to go look for him, and that meant trying to backtrack to where I'd seen him last. Because my life can never be simple, it turned out that Professor Orden had manipulated us into going to a place where she could kidnap Vera for her own purposes. Mostly to help her with finishing a project related to artificial attunements. Vera was apparently a big part of researching a new type of artificial attunements, designed to make humans as powerful as god beasts. Echeon was one of the first test subjects. Orden wanted to expedite the process of making more of these powerful artificial attuned in order to use them as weapons for Velia. That's the nation we're in right now, if you're not familiar. I know you're not from around here. Oh, and Orden had been involved with kidnapping Tenjin, so there was that. I also found out some of the people she'd worked with on that. One was a powerful summoner named Alora Theus, and an emerald-level swordsman. Orden actually wanted me to work with her group. I was a little conflicted, of course, since she was one of my professors, but I couldn't agree with her plans, both for ethical reasons and because I didn't think her plans would actually work. She was not only provoking a war, She was risking our nation's survival on a tremendous number of variables, and I couldn't agree to that. It just wasn't strategically sound. So I decided to fight. Now, there were five other people there, so fighting Ordon should have been easy, right? 5-on-1? Except she'd tricked Derek into putting on a ring earlier. A ring that made him follow her every command. Which was bad, because Derek was an Emerald level attuned. Which, if you're not familiar, is as powerful as it gets. At least as far as we know. So, with Derek and Ordon against us, we promptly ran away. We ran, like, a lot. Ultimately, we got caught, though, and had to fight. I gave Sarah a magic potion that I'd been saving, one that I thought would make whoever drank it more powerful. This may have been a slight miscalculation. It did make her more powerful, enough to turn the tide in the fight, at least. We knocked Ordon and Derek out cold. Unfortunately, that potion didn't work exactly the way I'd hoped, and now Sarah's attunement appears to be broken and she can't talk. Oops. So yeah, that was all bad. And then it got worse. Jin decided to shoot Vera in the back. Like, repeatedly. This was an immediate strain on our nascent love life. I tackled him. We did some wrestling of the decidedly non-romantic variety until I exploited a weakness in one of the magical items I'd made him earlier and made it explode. Which, you guessed it, blew up my hand. Not entirely. Just enough to put some nice shards of metal into it. It hurt Jin a lot more, though. They say the shortest way to a man's heart is through his sternum, after all. Hm? Is that not an expression? I feel like I've been lied to. Anyway, he still probably would have beaten me if Vaniv hadn't punched him in the face. Oh, Vaniv? Yeah, you'll like him. He's a summoned monster. And he's adorable. Anyway, yeah. I cobbled a healing item together with a rock. Not the most conventional form of enchanted item, but I work with what I've got. Magic rock is the best. Don't you dare make fun of it. I used that to get Vera back into stable condition. Found some of Katashi's blood. I imagine that was your work. Thanks for that. And then used a thing called the Jaden Box to summon Katashi to our location. Katashi took Vera and healed me up, but he wasn't able to heal Sarah. So he gave me a crazy artifact sword, Sarah's, to give her instead. Which is nice, I guess. I'm still not sure what to think about that. He sent me to you after that. Then you defeated me in battle with a chicken leg before I had a chance to introduce myself. I'm not ashamed by this. I'm exhausted and absolutely done with fighting people. So that's why I'm here. Sorry for rambling. I'm tired. I just barely survived someone that I trusted, and I'm not sure if my sister is going to be able to use her attunement again. It hasn't been the best day for me. How have you been, Karis? A bit after explaining that whole story to Karis, I found my way back to Lorien Heights. Derek offered us all a place to stay for a while, and we accepted. I had something I needed to do in private, after I'd made sure that everyone was safe and stable. I opened Trials of Judgment, my magic book, and I saw a message inside that wasn't exactly what I'd been expecting. Chapter 1. Well, that was unexpected. I stared blankly at the open book in front of me, rereading the final lines. "And I'll be especially interested in seeing your next move, little brother. Survive. And you'll soon see mine, Tristan Cadence." I'd spent the last 5 years of my life wondering about Tristan's fate. Had he somehow survived failing the tests? If he had died, could I bargain with the goddess to resurrect him if I reached the top of the tower? I had my answer now. Tristan not only survived, he spent the last 5 years practicing how to sound like the villain from a stage play. I allowed myself a weak chuckle, but I didn't feel like my joke was particularly funny. The situation didn't feel funny either, nor did it feel as joyous as it should have. This wasn't how our reunion was supposed to happen. I felt sick. I let my disbelief influence me for a moment while I wrote a reply. Dear voice of the tower, if you are Tristan Cadence, I would appreciate some proof. Corin. There was no immediate reply, just as I'd expected. I wasn't even sure the book was capable of sending me additional messages while I was in Derek Hardigan's manor. I knew the place was supposed to be heavily warded. I didn't know enough about the specific runes to know if they would block whatever form of enchantment made this book function. I frowned as I contemplated that. How does this book work? I hadn't seen obvious runes within it, like on traditional enchanted items. It did glow while I looked at it with my attunement active, however. I spent a moment searching the book using my attunement, realizing that the part that glowed the most intensely was the inside of the spine where the pages were attached. That implied that the runes were underneath the paper. If that was true, I'd have to remove the pages in order to see the runes. Not a bad way of concealing them, since taking out the paper could potentially render the book's magic inert. Maybe I could find a diviner with a spell for seeing through material. That would probably work, but then I'd have to be willing to show the book to someone else. Or I could make an item with that function. That'd be better, both due to my distrust for others and because I could see an item with that spell being useful for other applications. I'd succeeded at distracting myself briefly with that line of thought, but Tristan's declaration snapped me out of my reverie when the moment of interest wore off. I'd asked the book for proof, but I didn't need much of it. Katashi had already told me directly that Tristan had been involved with the disappearance of Visage Tengen. The writing in the book was consistent with that. Resh! What do I do? If Tristan really was one of the people organizing this, was I willing to work against him? He hadn't been bothered that we'd successfully defeated Orden and turned her over to Katashi, so he clearly had his own angle on this affair. What was it? Was he the one currently overseeing the production of Artificial Attuned? Or perhaps the one watching over the visage they held as a prisoner? Both were possible. Both would put him in immediate danger now that Katashi knew that he was involved. Vera had described a tall, emerald-level swordsman who had attacked Visage Tengen directly. I'd assumed that was Derek, but my brother was the same age and a similar build. Now that I knew Derek wasn't connected to this whole mess, it was possible that Tristan had been the attacker. How can I look into this further? Tristan had clearly been observing me through the book, as well as sending messages to manipulate me into the course of action he wanted me to take. I'd learned that he was a Whisper, one of the secret servants of the Visages, and that meant he had the necessary trust to make changes to the tower itself. That was presumably how he'd managed to place the book somewhere I would find it. It was also probably how he made sure I had a key to open a cell door and why the cell doors had locks that were meant to be opened by someone taking the test. The dead teenager I'd found in front of the bars implied that it was possible I hadn't been Tristan's first choice. I didn't know how deep his abilities to influence the tower went. Was he able to shift the layout of the rooms themselves to make sure I followed a path to that prison? I had no idea. One thing I would have to learn more about was how the Whispers worked and their level of influence. That might help me narrow down whether or not Tristan was currently inside the spire, and if so, how much freedom he had to move around and confound any search. Another thing I'd have to look into was how the book worked. If Tristan had been using it to spy on me, could I find a way to reverse that process? Was he just writing in a similar book of his own to send me messages, or did he have another method of sending writing to it? How was he viewing me from a distance? If I could view Tristan from a distance, I'd gain a major advantage in finding him and learning what he was truly up to. Third, I'd need to look into what Alora Theus was up to. How deeply involved had she been? Fourth, I'd seen my mother working with Alora Theus in the city council chamber when I'd viewed the contents of a memory crystal. It was the first I'd seen of my mother in years, and I discovered that she'd somehow managed to secure an important government position. Did that imply that Mother was working with Alora on this whole affair? Did that further imply that my mother was aware of Tristan's situation and had chosen not to tell me? If so, she had a great deal to answer for. That last line of thought made me realize that I was neglecting something important while I was fixating on solving this newly arisen puzzle. I'd been terrible about sharing what I knew with my family. Telling my mother about this was questionable. It would be a sign of trust, and if she wasn't involved, I'd be doing her a great kindness. But if she was involved, telling her I knew about Tristan was playing my hand openly. Then again, if she was working directly with Tristan, he could just tell her that himself. So I'd tell my mother. Maybe not immediately. It'd be safer to do it in person. I wrote her a quick letter, one that I'd hand off to a courier in the morning after I'd had a chance to acquire a seal for it. Dear Mother, I didn't heed your warnings, as I'm sure you expected. Fortunately, I'm alive and relatively intact. I have a considerable amount of information that I believe you would be interested in. In specific, I am aware of Kara Salirian's current whereabouts. I also have conclusive evidence that he was not involved in Visage Tengen's current situation. Due to the sensitive nature of this information, I would like to share it with you in person in an area that is warded against observation. I understand that this letter may take some time to reach you, and that you have other responsibilities, but I would like to meet at your earliest convenience. I hope you are well. Corin. She'd last told me that she had urgent business in Delanos. That was months ago, however, and I hoped she was back from her journey. If I didn't receive a reply within a week or so, I'd see if I could find a wayfarer who could send her a message with magic. I wanted to avoid that route for now because it would require giving that wayfarer all the information in the letter, which wasn't a great idea. For the moment, though, I had other family members to attend to. My father? Given how he'd treated me, I didn't feel the world's strongest urge to be kind to him. But I couldn't justify hiding this knowledge forever just because of how he'd treated me. I planned to tell him as soon as I could safely travel to his estate and figure out what I wanted to say. That would probably be sometime after I finished my first year of classes. I had another family member that was closer, though, and one who deserved answers as much as I did. I left my room, taking the book with me, and knocked softly on the door to the guest bedroom where Sarah was staying. Fortunately, the Hartigan Manor was large enough that she had a room to herself. "It's Corin," I added after a moment. I heard some shuffling within the room. About 30 seconds passed before she opened the door, her eyes narrowed and her hair hilariously askew. She'd been sleeping. Honestly, seeing her like that reminded me of how similar we looked when she hadn't gone through her morning hair wrestling and general beautification rituals. Her hair was a little longer than mine, but it was the same black with a bit of wave to it, and we had a similar athletic sort of build. Neither of us was as skinny as Marissa, but we were both in good shape. I grinned at her disheveled appearance. "Can I come in?" She waved me inside and closed the door behind us. She went to sit on her bed. I pulled over a chair from the nearby writing desk. "We need to talk." She tilted her head to the side, narrowed her eyes, and pointed at her throat. I coughed in apology. It was too easy to forget that she couldn't talk. She still hadn't recovered from the damage she'd sustained drinking the potion I'd given her in the tower. I'll have to figure out a way to help her. It's my fault she's in this bad of shape. I shifted the book to show it to her. Poor choice of words. I mean, I need to tell you something, or really to show you something. I handed the book to her. She raised an eyebrow. Look at the last few pages that have writing. She nodded, flipping through the pages until she reached the end, then going back a bit. I waited patiently while she read. Her eyes visibly widened when she read the part I'd expected, then she slammed the book shut and handed it back to me. "Yeah, I'm..." She raised a hand to quiet me, then moved over to the writing desk and retrieved a pencil and paper. We were lucky that Derek had a pencil and an eraser available. Pens were far more common in Velia. She scribbled a quick message on the paper. "What are the odds that it's really Tristan?" I winced. "Unfortunately, rather high. Right before we left the tower, Katashi said something about Tristan being involved with Tengen's disappearance. I found that book right when I walked into the tower for my judgment, and I've seen evidence that it can be used as a tracking device." I hesitated for a moment before continuing. It was difficult to admit my conclusions out loud. "I think Tristan has been keeping an eye on me and manipulating me this entire time." Her next reply was simply writing, "Resh." I sighed in assent. Yeah. There was a part of me that was relieved that she didn't react with joy at hearing that Tristan was alive. On some level, I felt like I was fundamentally broken for failing to be happy about the revelation. I was supposed to be overjoyed that he was alive, wasn't I? Sarah scratched another message on the page. Don't do anything drastic. We'll figure this out. I gave her my best effort at a smile in response. It wasn't a very good one. A half smile at best, but I tried. Thanks. She put a hand on mine. I tensed at the physical contact, but I didn't pull away. Sarah was trying to comfort me, and maybe she needed a bit of comfort herself. We hadn't really talked about how Tristan's disappearance had affected her in any depth. We were all close as children, but the little bit that she told me recently gave me the impression he wasn't always nice to her. A part of me wanted to ask her about it, but I wasn't sure I was ready for the answer. I didn't think I could handle my opinion of Tristan sinking any further. I'd idolized him for so long. I'd fought so hard to try to find a way to bring him back home, to try to fix the bonds that had broken in his absence. Was that all just childish idealism? I sighed, closing my eyes. Thanks, Sarah. You're right. We'll get this sorted out together. I gave her a quick hug, the most contact I could tolerate. She relaxed a little, seeming grateful for the contact. We were very different in that regard. Then I took the book and headed back to my room to try to rid my doubts. That, of course, only made me think about them even more. A few hours later, I heard a knock at my door. Before I could respond, a voice said,
"It's Patrick! Can I come in?"
I groaned and closed my book. "Yeah, sure." Patrick opened the door and stepped in, closing the door behind him. He gave me a conspiratorial whisper, which was just about as loud as his normal voice.
"I heard the news about Tristan. You must be so excited."
My initial reaction was a combination of horror and frustration that Sarah had told him. How could she be the one to break the news to others? Tristan was my brother, after all, not her. Oh, right. Even once I'd processed the fact that she probably did have an equal claim to any information about Tristan, I still felt irritated. I would have waited longer, taken some time to verify his identity, figure out a plan. She could have at least asked me before telling anyone else. And then it occurred to me that I'd more or less done the same thing to her when I'd made Patrick my retainer, without even bothering to consult her about it. I was still irritated, even knowing that, but at least I knew I was being unfair. "I'm not sure it's him," I replied instinctively. Patrick nodded, grabbing a chair and sitting down.
"Sure, but it sounds like it is. And why would someone bother going to all the trouble to pretend to be your brother? It's not like you're that important."
I don't think Patrick realized how insulting that last part sounded. But I ignored that, processing the answer. It could be that whoever I've been communicating with has figured out who I am and done research to figure out the easiest way to manipulate me.
"Communicating?"
Patrick frowned.
"I thought you just heard about Tristan from Katashi."
I realized I'd made a misstep by assuming Sarah had told Patrick everything. "I have a magical item that sends and receives messages from someone in the spire. I found it in my judgment. The person I'm talking to claims to be Tristan."
"Wow."
Patrick blinked.
"You must be thrilled. I've never heard anything about something like that happening before."
"Yeah, that's part of why I'm skeptical. It seems too good to be true." Patrick leaned closer to me, looking concerned.
"Are you feeling okay? I thought you'd be ecstatic, but you look awful. I mean, worse than usual."
I waved a hand dismissively, trying not to feel insulted. "My injuries are healing fine. My back was pretty beaten up, but..."
"That's not what I mean, Corin. You look upset."
I sighed. "I don't know. This is what I wanted, isn't it?" Patrick nodded.
"Since the moment he disappeared, you never gave up on him. You always believed he was alive somewhere."
I shook my head. "I wanted to believe that when he vanished, but the reality sunk in pretty quickly thereafter. I didn't believe there was a high chance he'd survived. There are a few stories of people escaping the spire years later, like Meredith Hawkins, but yeah, that was probably just a con artist with the shapeshifter attunement. And there was that one you always talked about with Johannes Eddington, but he'd stayed in the spire deliberately to try to form long-lasting memories of a judgment. But he told people he was going to do that in advance and packed supplies for it, and even he came out after a couple months. I sighed. Exactly. So I'd more or less assumed he was probably dead or otherwise trapped in the spire. I still figured I could fix it, though. Or rather, the goddess could fix it if I actually made it to the top of the spire. I've never understood why more people don't try to climb the spire for that kind of boon. I think most people find it easier to accept death and move on than to spend their entire lives working toward a goal they might never accomplish. And I think a part of it is that you're not, quite as devout as most people, Corin. I raised an eyebrow. What do you mean? Well, don't take this the wrong way, but you always tried to avoid saying the prayers in school when we were younger. I get the impression you don't have a lot of faith in the goddess. I shrugged. I believe she exists. I just don't particularly believe in praying to someone who sets up a system that kills thousands of teenagers every year. Patrick visibly winced. That's not really fair. She's testing people for the qualities that are... I waved a hand. I've read the scriptures, Patrick. I know the doctrine. The goddess blesses those who demonstrate the courage to risk themselves, the strength to defend others, and the insight to know their own weaknesses. I'd think that would encourage more people to take the risks to try to climb the spire and resurrect someone they cared about, if anything.
That's just the thing, Corin. You see people dying in the spire as a tragedy, and it is, in a way. But dying also sends their spirits to the goddess's kingdom, where they will be rewarded and, in time, reborn.
Ah, that. I'd never seen that as anything other than an empty platitude for people mourning the dead. A way for people to feel a little less horrible about the awfulness of losing someone they cared about. But if people were taking it literally, that did go a long way toward explaining why most people weren't quite as obsessed with bringing back their deceased family members as I was. Was there something wrong with me? It wasn't that I didn't believe that the goddess existed. I'd seen the spires, earned an attunement, and even met one of her visages in person. I just couldn't square the idea of the same entity that makes spires with murderous traps and monsters also being benevolent enough to care for the spirits of the dead in some kind of utopian afterlife. If Selyse was capable of making a utopian kingdom at all, why not extend that to all of us? I'd read the scriptures for their answers, of course. The idea of adversity testing our resolve and building us into better people. Some verses even indicated that the trials that one underwent in life would help to dictate the specific roles of the spirits in the goddess's kingdom, or even in subsequent lives. But none of that addressed the inherent unfairness of the mortal world. A goddess with Selyse's obvious power could be doing more. I remember reading in the scriptures about the early days when the goddess wrought miracles, turned rivers aside, and made whole lands fertile. She walked the lands in person, healing the injured and curing the diseased. Then she raised the spires, and the miracles stopped. She'd done her good deeds and turned to playing games with human lives. Even if the spires had some sort of value for strengthening the spirit, I sincerely doubted that there was any spiritual benefit for the children who died from famine or disease. If there was any truth to the legends of her miracles, she had the power to stop those tragedies from occurring. From that, I concluded that she either had chosen to stop helping us, or that she'd never truly had that power at all. The most charitable interpretation I could devise was that she'd used up some of her power making the spires. That seemed like a good deal of effort, even for a deity. If the spires had purely served as a way to give out magic to humanity, I might have even called that a benevolent decision. But with tens of thousands of people that entered the spire disappearing each year, I had a hard time believing yet. And even if the spires were purely meant to help us, maybe she could have set up a way to give those of us who'd lost someone some real closure. There were common answers for all that, too. That it was up to humanity to solve our own problems, to prove ourselves and grow as a species. It had always come across to me like a king telling a pauper that he just needed to try harder. In other words, complete nonsense.
Corin, you okay?
I'd gotten distracted with my own introspection again. Sorry, I'm just processing.
I understand. It has to be a lot to take in. But you were right this whole time, Corin. Your brother is out there. You should feel vindicated by that.
I didn't like other people telling me how I should feel, but I knew Patrick was only trying to cheer me up, and I was grateful for that. I took a breath. He's not like what I expected. Patrick gave me a sympathetic look.
Of course he's changed. It's been 5 years, and who knows what he's been through in there.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't expecting things to go this way. I think I'll be okay. I just need to adjust my plans a bit. My words sounded hollow, but I tried to believe them.
Okay, good. Just let me know if you need anything, okay? If you need to rescue Tristan from the spire, I'll be glad to help.
I gave a little laugh at that. Thanks, Patrick. I paused for a minute, then added,
You're a good friend.
I don't deserve you.
Patrick scoffed. That's silly. You always used to stick up for me when we were little. Friends help each other out. That's what we're here for.
Thanks. I took a breath. I think I need a little time to myself, if you don't mind.
Of course. If you need me, though, you know where to find me.
I nodded and waved. Patrick left the room. The conversation should have helped. It was nice to know that Patrick was there to help me if I needed it. But he was right. I wasn't happy about what I'd learned about Tristan. It wasn't just that things hadn't gone the way I'd expected, although I had to admit that was a part of it. It was the sinking feeling that the person I'd been talking to was Tristan, but that he was so far from the brother I'd lost that I wouldn't recognize him. It was the nagging worry that whatever Tristan had become after 5 years away was not the type of person that I could trust. And perhaps that he might even end up being my enemy. Questions, frustrations, and scenarios wouldn't stop running through my mind. Morning light was pouring in my window before I finally slept. I woke to the sound of clashing steel. I literally rolled out of my bed, drawing Selyse Lian in a single motion. If Ordin had seen that the first time she'd tested me with that midnight ambush, she might have been impressed. There were no intruders in my room. The sound of metal was coming from above me. I rushed out the door, still wearing my night clothes. I had my phoenix sigil pinned to my pants, so I wasn't completely defenseless if we were under attack. I found a stairwell leading up, terminating at a hatch. The sounds of clashing metal were closer now. I opened it cautiously, keeping my sword in my offhand. A blur of motion crossed over the open hatch, too fast for me to follow. I stepped back instinctively, taking a parrying posture, but nothing followed me down. A glance told me that the hatch led up to the rooftop, which was a flat design of solid stone. This mansion was built less like a standard house and more like a small fortress. I pulled myself up onto the rooftop, taking a defensive pose. A black-garbed man flashed past me, swinging his sword in a broad arc. A shockwave ripped out of his blade, arcing toward his opponent. As he twitched his left hand a moment later, the shockwave split apart into 6 separate projectiles. On the opposite side of the roof, Derek calmly swiveled on his heel, cutting apart the projectiles with a sword in either hand. He had a smirk on his face.
That the best you can do?
His attacker, Karis Salirian, raised a hand to his chin.
No, but I'm not sure if you could handle anything more. After all, you're unarmed.
Derek's twin swords, ordinary training swords, not magical ones, fell to pieces. To my left side, I heard Patrick and Marissa laugh. They were sitting with plates on their laps and a bottle of liquid between them. Sarah was standing a few feet away, watching the exchange with folded arms, but her eyes were curious. Patrick turned to me almost immediately.
Hey, you're awake! Come sit! They're just getting started!
I groaned as I realized what I was witnessing. Yesterday, Karis had made a remark about taking Derek up to the roof. Apparently that hadn't been a joke. I was half tempted to just go back downstairs and pull a pillow over my eyes, but my stomach grumbled at the sight of the plates in front of Patrick and Marissa. Is there extra food? Patrick waved me over.
I'll share and we can get more downstairs later.
He patted the rooftop next to him. Come on! Karis and Derek paused their exchange to allow me to get close enough to sit down next to Patrick. I hadn't brought the scabbard for Selyse Leanne, so I just put it on the ground next to me and kept an eye on it to make sure no one stepped on it. Patrick offered me an apple, and Marissa handed me a block of cheese. I nodded gratefully to both of them.
Sufficient?
I sat and ate while the two swordsmen repositioned themselves. The roof was huge, probably 50 feet long and maybe 30 feet in width. Normally, it would have been more than enough room to spar safely, even with us innocent bystanders sitting and watching. But these were hardly normal combatants. I sincerely hoped they were paying enough attention to avoid collateral damage. The barrier from my phoenix sigil wouldn't do much against a direct hit from either of them.
You need me to fix those?
Karis waved at the broken swords that Derek was holding.
No need.
Derek held up the two hilts and concentrated. Blades of fire extended from the shattered metal, flickering in the wind, but retaining a near solid state.
I think you'll find this somewhat harder to cut.
Karis took a step forward, taking a medium fencing stance with his sword blade extended.
You might be surprised.
Derek rushed forward, crossing the rooftop at a sprint. He swept the flaming blades downward. Karis raised his own weapon to parry, but the fire swords went right through it without resistance. They were fire, not steel, after all. Karis stepped back, avoiding the cuts a moment before they landed. Then, the flaming blades separated into pieces and dispersed. Derek stared downward at the hilts, then looked back up toward Karis.
I'm going to be honest. I'm pretty sure that shouldn't be possible. Fire doesn't work like that.
Karis grinned.
Anything can be cut. At least, if you're me.
Derek narrowed his eyes.
I suppose I'll need to put in a hint of effort then.
I'd never seen Derek look this stymied before, but he didn't seem angry. From his expression, he looked like he was finally starting to take this sparring match seriously. That could be bad for us mere bystanders. Derek took a step backward, lifting the hilts again. Instead of flames, the blades that grew from the hilts were new metal. A shining white material that I didn't recognize. His aura flared bright yellow and extended over the weapons, visible even without my attunement active. He was wrapping the swords in his shroud, protecting them from being broken. Not a bad strategy, but I couldn't do it myself. I'd need to be at least Sunstone level to do something like that. Derek rushed forward again, keeping his left arm down in a blocking position while he swung with his right. His sword met Karis's, and this time it held. Barely. The aura around Derek's sword flickered and cracked as their swords pressed together. Karis smirked and pushed his blade down. Derek stepped back, breaking the push, and swung his offhand at Karis's midsection. A golden wave of force followed the cut. Karis cut that in half, but it was a distraction. Derek stomped his foot. Spikes ripped free from the rooftop and flew upward. Karis, mid-swing from cutting the last attack apart, barely managed to dance backward to dodge the rock projectiles. That wasn't the real attack, either. When Karis landed, his feet immediately began to sink into the rooftop. A section of stone had liquefied. Derek snapped his fingers. Karis's feet were embedded in stone. He spared a glance downward, looking introspective, and then raised his blade into a defensive stance.
Not bad. Planning ahead, I see. What's next?
Well, since you can't dodge, Derek raised his open hand and pointed it at Karis. A sphere of flame manifested in his palm.
Let's see how much damage you can handle, shall we?
Derek hurled the sphere. It detonated a few feet in front of Karis, the explosion obscuring the area. I had to raise a hand to shield my eyes from both the brightness and the debris. Then Derek hurled another fireball, and another, and another. He shoved his blade into the rooftop and hurled them faster, using both hands.
A good 30 seconds passed before I could see Karras clearly again. Smoke was rising from his skin, but he showed no sign of injury. He shook his head.
Has throwing a barrage of weak attacks ever worked for anyone? Karras sighed. You're not taking this seriously.
The translucent aura around Karras flickered silver for just an instant.
In that instant, the section of floor beneath Karras vanished, removing the stone that had encased his feet. The gap beneath him was a smooth, round section, like an invisible sphere had cut into it.
There was no trace of the missing stone, not even dust.
I stared, evaluating what I was seeing. It was a subtle thing, nothing as flashy as the blasts of flame that Derek had been hurling, but the implications were far more terrifying. He'd annihilated that area without even blinking. I'd never seen anything like it.
Then Karras was gone. His sword remained behind, jammed into the rooftop like Derek's. I shifted my head, and there he was again, behind Derek. He flicked a finger into Derek's back. Crack! A shockwave of force blasted Derek off his feet, sending him forward several feet. He landed, skidding across the ground, and spun to hurl a jet of flame as a counterattack. Karras wasn't there, though. I couldn't follow his movement at all. He looked like he was teleporting, but his running stance when he reappeared told me otherwise. He was just moving too fast for me to see. Derek started to swing a fist, and then he flew backward again. Karras stood with his right hand extended with an open palm. He smirked. When Derek landed, his aura flared emerald. I managed to follow the blur of Karras' movements the next time, and I saw him reappear. Derek had caught Karras' hand. Their fingers were interlocked. For a moment, the two fighters paused. Sparks crackled in the air as their shrouds met and pushed against each other. Karras shoved his hand forward. Derek frowned, forced back a step by the motion, and threw a kick with his forward leg. Karras raised his opposite leg to block and threw a punch with his free hand, but Derek moved his head to the side and avoided it. Derek stomped the floor again. Karras jumped to avoid the spikes that formed, but Derek maintained his grip and yanked Karras back down. Karras answered by kicking both legs into Derek's chest as he descended, breaking the link between their hands and hurling the combatants apart. Karras was moving again the instant he landed, but four walls of stone leapt out of the ground around Derek. Karras punched through the closest wall repeatedly, digging fist-sized holes with each strike. A blast of lightning shot out through the largest hole and hit Karras dead on, knocking him back. Karras shivered briefly, his expression showing a flicker of pain.
Interesting. I think that's the first attack Derek has managed to land that had any real effect.
Karras blurred again, reappearing next to the wall. The aura around his hand flickered brighter. The wall collapsed into a dozen perfectly symmetrical pieces. Derek had electricity dancing along his fingers when he appeared amidst the rubble. He punched Karras in the face with an electrically charged fist. Karras recoiled from the blow, but it didn't slow him much. He raised his own hand, but Derek moved quicker this time, shoving both hands toward Karras's chest. A blinding column of lightning sent Karras staggering back and flowed continuously into him without abating. Karras's aura brightened, shining silver. Then a section of lightning was just gone. It was just like what had happened with the stone. As soon as the lightning was getting within range of a spherical aura around Karras, it simply vanished into nothingness. The floor beneath Karras disintegrated at the same time, and he dropped down an inch before his aura normalized. Derek pressed the attack, but the moment to recover was all Karras needed. He raised a hand of his own, palm outward, and shoved it into the oncoming lightning. The voltaic stream split apart, jutting out to Karras' sides without touching him. He waved his hand upward and a crescent blade of energy shot through the lightning stream toward Derek, cleaving through the electrical column with ease. Derek sidestepped the cutting wave, but that forced him to abandon the lightning attack. Karras vanished, reappearing next to Derek and sweeping his hand downward in a cutting motion. I saw Derek's emerald aura tear as Karras's hand passed through it. Karras's fingers passed within inches of Derek's neck. A bloody line appeared on Derek's skin, in the hand's wake. I felt a surge of panic, standing up out of instinct, but when Derek raised his own hand and wiped the blood away, it was clearly nothing more than a scratch. That wasn't because of Derek's aura protecting him, though, or his own reaction. That perfect of a cut, leaving nothing but a reminder. That was deliberate. It was masterful. Derek knew it, too. Many fighters would have responded with anger or fear, but Derek's grin only widened. That was a far more dangerous response.
That's...
Derek looked at the thin layer of blood on his hand.
You're not even in attuned at all, are you?
Karras took a step back and cracked his neck.
You're not wrong.
The rest of us were dead silent as we watched, still transfixed with the exchange. Derek's eyes brightened as he stepped back and assumed a defensive stance.
What are you, truly, then?
Karras put his hands together and cracked his knuckles.
Wouldn't it be more interesting if you figured it out on your own?
Yes, but I'd really rather you tell us anyway, I mused. Derek disagreed, apparently.
Oh, I've got some ideas, both about what you are and about your weaknesses.
Karras put his hands behind his head, stretching again.
That'd be interesting. I wasn't aware I had weaknesses.
Weaknesses are relative, and relative to me, everyone has weaknesses. Derek snapped his fingers.
Tavare, awaken!
I saw Derek's true weapons lying against a nearby wall. A column of golden light enveloped one of the weapons as it began to float of its own accord. With the sound of a chime, Tavare appeared. They were a perfectly sculpted golden figure, human save for the metallic scales that covered every inch of exposed skin aside from their face. Even their face was metallic in color, but the scales reflected with greater luster. Tavare rushed forward, a luminous blur, and took a defensive position in front of their master. Something was amiss, however. Tavare was trembling.
Master, you must withdraw. Radiance will engage this foe while you escape.
The golden scales flashed brighter, as if with determination. Derek blinked.
That won't be necessary, Tavare. We'll fight him together.
Tavare's eyes narrowed skeptically, but remained focused on Karras.
You must not fight this creature, Master. You must defend the others who are weaker than you. Radiance will defend for as long as it can. It has been an honor to serve you.
Karras tilted his head to the side, looking intrigued. He raised a hand and a blade-like distortion appeared around it. Tavare tensed as the weapon appeared, taking a step forward.
Go!
Derek put a hand on Tavare's shoulder.
That was a humbling speech you gave, Tavare, but this is just a sparring match. There's no need to be concerned.
Tavare shuddered again.
You do not understand what you face, Master.
The golden-skinned creature stepped forward, raising their blade toward Karras.
Radiance will not allow you to harm these mortals, monster.
Karras sighed.
Your master speaks truly, cousin. I do not mean these people harm.
Tavare continued to advance on Karras, blade outstretched, until their golden blade was pressed directly up against his chest.
Then withdraw. Radiance will not...
Tavare's blade was no longer in their hand. It embedded itself into the stone nearby. Derek surged forward, but he wasn't fast enough. Karras's hand was at the elemental's neck, the blade-like aura still glimmering in place. Tavare fell to their knees.
Radiance begs forgiveness for daring to raise a blade against you, Great One. They offer their life for the offense, but implores you to spare these humans. The humans are young and have great potential.
Karras shook his head sadly, lowering his blade hand and putting his other hand on top of Tavare's head. A red-bladed sword appeared in Derek's hand.
If you mean to hurt Tavare, I will stop you.
Karras sighed and rustled Tavare's short metallic hair. You're a loyal one. I meant it when I said I don't mean these people any harm. You have nothing to fear from me. Tavare raised their head just an inch.
Truly?
The blade-like aura around Karras's right hand faded. I have no interest in harming anyone if I can avoid it. Tavare's expression twisted into a frown.
But Such is your essence, Great One. How can you not harm?
Karras pulled his other hand away, then knelt down and looked straight into Tavare's eyes. For a moment, even at a distance, I could see silver in his